I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Dr. James Hughes, a bioethicist, the executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and the author of Citizen Cyborg, Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future. So thanks, James, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, yeah, for my listeners who maybe are not familiar with it, could you elaborate on what IET is and kind of how it came to be, and what is the reason for its existence?
Well, back in 2002, I started to work with the World Transhumanist Association, and then I became its first executive director. And there were 10 of us on the board of directors, and six of us or five of us wanted to kill the other five. And that history of fractiousness within the transhumanist movement is now quite familiar to people, no matter which
right.
Time you put your foot in the pond, and there's some kind of fight going on. And there was partly politics and partly personal, but there were five of us who wanted to have at least some minimal set of agreements about what a transhumanist intervention into public policy would look like, and we were not libertarians. And so we agreed that there should, among the five of us, that there should be states, and that there should be Food and Drug Administrations, and that there should be national health insurance, and other things that were not consensual within the arguments that we were having. We also saw back then, and I think it's less the case now, that there were lots of intellectuals and people in the policy circles and academics who were sympathetic with their ideas, but who did not by any stretch want to be associated with an ism, and in particular, a transhumanism. They just saw that as academic death to have that kind of a label. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted an organization that didn't have that right in the banner. We also wanted an organization that was politically structured differently than the World Transhumanist Association, because part of the reason that there were all these political fights in the WTA was that it was a democratically, it was then and is no longer, a democratically controlled organization. And so there were, anyone who paid dues basically could vote, and there were these constant battles over getting, your friends and family to pay dues so you could get elected to the board. And so we wanted to have a little bit more control over it, and we thought that would also generate more funding. That has unfortunately not turned out to be the case, but it's certainly been a lot quieter in the IET than it used to be in the WTA. Mm-hmm. So Nick Bostrom and I were the first co-founders, and I was the executive director. He was chairman of the board. And quite shortly after that, he got his $10 million from James Martin and buggered off to England and started doing good work over there instead of doing it here at Yale. The Future of Humanity Institute took his energies.
Yeah.
And the rest of us started to work on the IET. We have held 8 major conferences and lots of little events over the years. We took over the journal, what used to be the Journal of Transhumanism and is now the Journal of Evolution and Technology. And that has gone gangbusters. We eventually found a philanthropist or two to give us some money, and that allowed us to get some managing directors who started to build up our contributor list. And now we have 24 fellows and 24 affiliate scholars and about 250 different contributors at one time or another.
Yeah.
And we have a program of work that I think is quite respectable about global catastrophic risks and the longevity dividend and engaging with images of the future in popular culture that we find, less than helpful.
Yeah.
So we've been doing a lot of good work. And one of those kinds of work that we've done, because the chairman of our board now, George Dvorsky, and I, and another member of the board, Michael Atura, are Buddhists. Mm. And another member of the board, Julia Prisco, is very involved in the theological issues around transhumanism.
Yeah.
So we've always been interested in these issues, at least at the top. It's when we do our polling of the IET audience, it's not always in their list of concerns of things that we should be addressing. But that's okay. You know, we all have different flavors. And we work on the other issues as well. Of course, technological unemployment is popular right now. But the religious and theological questions, and in particular, the impacts of neurotechnology on human morality and spiritual experience, are things that we've been very engaged with since the beginning. And we call that the Cyborg Buddha Project.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that. And I want to come back and talk about the longevity dividend as well. Also kind of this idea of what kind of vision is in society. But could you kind of, I've heard a little bit of your backstory, and I'm curious about how you kind of got interested in this and kind of the road that brought you into engagement with some of these issues.
Well, my parents were small-time Methodists, and when they got to Columbus, Ohio in the early 60s, they became Unitarian Universalists, and I was raised a Unitarian, and first got exposed to Buddhism through Unitarianism, eventually when I was in high school, had my existential crisis and realized that Unitarianism was pretty thin spiritual gruel to get me through the questions that I was asking. And happened upon Buddhism. And the thing that attracted me about Buddhism was that I've always been non-theistic. Mm-hmm. And also that I'm not a moral realist. I don't believe that it's self-evident that there are rights and wrongs in the universe. Mm-hmm. And so that when I was 17 and smoking a spliff, you know, was really blowing my mind. It's like, you know, why get out of bed and do anything in the morning? If there's no right and wrong in the universe, it's just a bunch of atoms. And Buddhism came along and said, hey, you don't have to believe in right and wrong. Just look at your own mind and figure out the path that really leads to happiness. And it turns out that it's being nice to people and being patient and understanding these sublime truths, which don't need any more self-justification than that they work in people's lives. Yeah. And that was the right thing for me to hear at the time. Eventually, I went to, I became a Tibetan Buddhist briefly then, and went to college, started a Buddhist meditation group, but I was also deeply involved in politics and on the left, and have been a democratic socialist for many years. And trying to figure out the relationship between my social justice commitments and my spiritual views eventually led me to Sri Lanka, where I worked for 2 years for a Buddhist development organization and ordained as a monk. I was looking after that in Japan. I was studying Zen in Japan after that. And I was looking for a career that would combine the philosophical issues I was interested in and the political engagement that I wanted to have, and discovered bioethics as a topic, that there were these public policy questions that were not self-evident to a traditional left-wing point of view, you know, whether the fetus has rights or not, or whether grandma should have her plug pulled or not. These are not self-evident questions. And in particular, the question that really got me going was the personhood of the brain dead and, you know, what you needed to have rights in our society in terms of what's going on upstairs. So when I got to graduate school, I wanted to write a thesis about abortion and brain death and Japan and the United States, and that was back in 1986. Mm. And I was also peripherally involved in green politics. I started a journal called the Eco-Socialist Review. And I started to realize, both in my political work and in my bioethics work, that I was far more techno-optimistic than most people in either domain. Yeah. Most of the people on the left had been deeply infected by one variant of Luddism or another, you know, that all corporations are evil, all technologies come from corporations, therefore they're all evil, or all technologies empower the already empowered, therefore men and white people and the capitalist ruling class will become more powerful because of new technologies. Or, you know, whatever the argument was, technology was bad on the left. And And then in the bioethics circles, the joke was you only needed one word to do bioethics, and that word was no, because everything that came along, you're just going to say no to.
Right.
And I didn't feel comfortable in either of those kinds of ideological spaces. So around about 1990, I discovered the Extropians, well, but maybe 91, I discovered the Extropians online and got on and said, gosh, it's so great to finally meet a bunch of people who are so technical enthusiasts like me. And the conversation went on for a little bit, and then it's like, and yeah, I'm a socialist too. And it's like, what? Because they were all, you know, rapid libertarians. So I wasn't very comfortable there, eventually left that. And when I got, I was a trailing spouse, my wife got a job here at University of Connecticut. And I started teaching here and doing research on HIV risk reduction. And one of my students had a radio show. And I discovered public radio. I'd been listening to, when I was in Sri Lanka, there was a civil war going on, and I had become an obsessive listener to BBC. Huh. And then in Chicago, in graduate school, I listened to WBZ, the public radio station, all the time. But I never thought about getting on the other side of the mic. And when I got here to University of Connecticut, I eventually got my own radio show, and it quickly became a podcast. If I'd only stuck in 2 years longer, I would have hit this podcast gold mine.
Timing.
But I gave up a couple years ago on podcasting. But I did that for 13 years. That was called Change Surfer Radio. And that was an entree for me, an opportunity for me to reach out to people who were writing interesting things, doing interesting things, in this intersection of bioethics, biopolitics, technology, science, and the left-wing versions of it that I was interested in. Then one of the other things that happened was that I'd written a paper for the International Network for the Definition of Death, which meets every 4 years in Havana, which, you know, talking about death in Havana is kind of a funny thing. Anyway, I had given that paper in 1996, and it basically said, eventually, we're going to have cryonics and nanorobotics and all these kinds of things. And once that happens, all of our current definitions of death will have to be rethought. And the cryonicists got a hold of that, and they loved it and invited me to an Alcor meeting. And then I met eventually Nick Bostrom and Mark Walker and some of the others. And that's when I got involved in the WTA. So it's a long, you know, I would say science fiction also contributed. I was a science fiction reader as a kid. Yeah. My dad was a futurist, subscribed us to the Futurist magazine in the 1970s. So there are a lot of threads that eventually led here. But I like to tell the story about the relationship to Buddhism and socialism because it's usually the most provocative for most of my audiences.
Yeah, and I think what you're describing, kind of, you know, coming into this this world of where people are suddenly excited about technology and its potential, but then you're finding kind of that you don't fit with a lot of the thought processes going on there. Yeah, I think I certainly had that same experience as well. I got interested in the kind of Extropian and transhumanist communities in the mid 90s. And, but I was a Christian preacher's kid. And I soon found that, that my ideas were not as, you know, not the same way, the same trajectory as everyone else's. So, so that's interesting. So
let me just mention one other thing. When I was in, undergraduate, I was at Oberlin College, and my major was sociology and anthropology. And I went to my my thesis advisor, and I said, I've got two theses I want to propose for my senior thesis, either the cross-cultural determinants of sexual deviance or the cross-cultural determinants of altered states of consciousness. Mm. And he said, well, my wife just left me for another woman, so I don't want to talk about sexual deviance this year. But I did enjoy taking peyote in graduate school, so I'd love to talk about altered states of consciousness. So I looked around, and I found a woman who was an expert in possession trance at Ohio State University, and I'm from Columbus, Ohio. And I went down and decided that I was going to do my senior thesis in the Pentecostal church. So I joined, looked around, I went to 8 different Pentecostal churches, and eventually I joined a church and tried to speak in tongues and went to 4 services a week, 4-hour services, 4, you know, Wow. It was intense for 4 months.
Wow.
Eventually spoke in tongues to their satisfaction, wrote a huge thesis about it. And it's on the IET website if you're curious. But at any rate, I've always had a strong fascination in religious sociology. I mean, even before that when I was Unitarian. But anyway, I just wanted to put that on the table. Because, unlike some Buddhists and certainly most transhumanists, I know a fair bit about Christianity.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. So let's talk about the thing you brought up, the longevity dividend. And what is that? What's the idea behind that?
So the way that longevity is framed usually in the transhumanist community is just, a self-evident good, that we all want to live longer and we should all aspire to that. But one of the arguments that is commonly, there are a number of tropes, it's like the guy in the prison and, somebody gets up and says four and everybody laughs,
right?
Because they all know the jokes so well. And at this point in the debate, we all know the trope arguments,
right,
against longevity, overpopulation, boredom, et cetera, et cetera. One of the arguments is that our social structure isn't really set up to take care of all these old people.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have a declining fertility rate, and public policy analysts, and this is something that a lot of transhumanists don't pay very much attention to, but public policy analysts have been worried about this for a long time. And and on the right, they talk about this in terms of the entitlement debate and the need to, claw back on the entitlements because we can't afford them. And,
mm-hmm.
And it's certainly true that if you just look at linear projections of the number of old folks and the rates of their disability and the amount that Medicare costs and the amount that Social Security would cost and things like that, then we're going to have some problems. Now, I think some of those problems can be solved through purely political means. Like if we just taxed income above the $120,000 limit or whatever for Social Security, we could probably take care of all the Social Security needs. It wouldn't run out. Medicare, if we just would buy our drugs from Canada instead of, paying the exorbitant prices that American pharmaceutical manufacturers require. Anyway, there's ways we could probably fix some of these problems, but the longevity argument, the longevity dividend argument is that if we were to delay aging, even, extend human life expectancy just by like a decade with therapies that delay aging, we would also then be pushing off all the chronic diseases,
mm-hmm.
And helping to compress what's called the compression of morbidity. So, the ideal life would be you're healthy, 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 and then you just drop dead instead of, getting sick at 60, living until 100 with a declining, health and needing nursing care and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the longevity dividend argument is that a sick and disabled elderly person is astronomically more expensive than an able-bodied senior citizen.
Yeah.
Not to mention that an able-bodied senior citizen often wants to participate in the paid or unpaid labor market in some way. They want to, give back to society. They want to do things.
Right.
But they also aren't requiring nursing care that often is provided by a wife or a sister or a daughter who has to step out of the labor force to take care of them, or a paid employee of a nursing facility. And they aren't eating a handful of pills every day for their disabilities and illnesses. So there's all kinds of ways in which this longevity dividend argument can be made. Now, there's a certain amount of standing on our head when we make it, because they're still going to eat and they're still going to need a place to live, and and there may not be any jobs for them. If we say that we have to raise the retirement age, as is often part of this debate, and I don't think a retirement age will make sense in a future of unlimited longevity.
Right.
But if we also then put that in the context of technological unemployment, where are they going to get these jobs? So this is why, one of the reasons why at the IET we've increasingly been talking about the basic income guarantee, is because the convergence of the employment shocks that are coming from technology and the socioeconomic shocks that are coming from longevity require a complete rethinking of the trajectory of school, work, retirement. And that's all.
Right. Yeah. So I do think a vision of kind of re-equipping all kinds of people to be productive and relational members of society, rather than kind of spending a long time in this kind of inevitable decline. I think that's a big thing for a lot of people, because a lot of people, when they discuss or they consider the idea of extending lifespan, they're imagining extending the unhealthy part of their lifespan, right? They're imagining just holding on for another few years. But what you're talking about is changing that dynamic completely, right? Like, you're extending the healthy part of human life and changing the way in which we relate economically and socially and all these ways with senior citizens.
That's right. And I've been teaching about this for a long time. And in general, what I've been able to say is that even without longevity medicine, that the rate of senior disability has been declining, and that we're getting healthier and healthier as we live longer. Unfortunately, the most recent data does not support that. And it doesn't really argue against the longevity dividend, because we're talking about drugs and therapies, which actually would have that effect, which would slow down the aging process. But one of the things that's happening is that Americans are getting so fat that our obesity is catching up with us in old age and causing disabilities that otherwise we wouldn't have got.
Yeah.
So even though we're smoking less and exercising more, and we're not retiring as early and all kinds of things, we're just so freaking fat.
Yeah. So for people who aren't familiar with the kind of basic argument for universal basic income, which you mentioned briefly, what would be your kind of 1 or 2 point argument in favor of that?
Well, first, I mean, the argument starts with, do we have any obligations to provide economic security for one another? Is that the kind of society we want to live in? And almost, every society in the world has said yes. level of so economic security needs to be provided, at least for those who are poor and so on.
Yeah.
But there are those, especially in the transhumanist community, who might beg to differ. So, we have to start the argument there. And then if you agree with that, then you have to say, well, what's the best way to go about this? You know, if you have a system where widows get this amount of money and unemployed people get this amount of money, and if you break your back, you get this amount of money, and if you can't afford food, you get food stamps, and if you can't afford housing, you get certain kinds of loans. Or could we have a society in which we just give everybody a check every month? And what effect would that have?
Yeah.
And then just let them figure it out. You know, they don't need the hand of the nanny state to tell them exactly how to spend this. Now, I don't think, I think that the libertarian aspect of that argument, I understand why it appeals to the right, because you can shrink the state. By doing that, you don't need to have all these bureaucrats looking over people's shoulders. People get more individual choice. I do think that there are people who make bad choices. You know, I think that even if you do that, you're going to find meth addicts lying in the street that you're going to have to take care of, and they spent their check, and you're still going to have to do something about that. So I'm not saying that, that this would be the libertarian paradise, but what we see when this kind of an experiment has been done, especially in development economics, there's a lot of work on trying to see, well, what happens if we give everybody a cow? And what happens if we give them just a doctor? And what happens if we just give them all a check? And it turns out if you give them all a check, some of them are going to buy a new roof for their thatched hut, and some of them are going to buy a cow, and some of them are going to take their kids to the doctor. And guess what? It turns out that everybody has a better idea what's in their own interests than the outside bureaucrat did. So that's one of the arguments. There's also the argument that technological unemployment may come along and whack all of our jobs. It was Mitt Romney who pointed out that 47% of Americans receive some kind of check from the government. And he was lamenting this fact. You know, senior citizens are getting checks, and veterans are getting checks. Everybody's getting checks, and they're all mooching off the hardworking people. Well, guess what? In the future, robots are going to take a lot of people's jobs, and then it's going to be 50%, 60%, 70% of people who are going to be getting checks.
Yeah.
Eventually, it might be so many people that we just decide to have a new system altogether, and that's the argument for UBI.
Yeah. Cool. So, you've talked about the kind of investigation into religion and religious thought that a lot of you at on the board of IET are kind of looking into. And I'm familiar with Julio and you know, a lot of thought there. So kind of tell me what some of the thought processes or lines of exploration are you pursuing in that direction?
Well, I'll also mention Hank. Mm-hmm. Hank Pellissier, our current managing director. I think, you know, Hank is, like me, an atheist. But the reason that he's been impressed with Christian transhumanism and Mormon transhumanism is that people from a religious and institutional religion background are much more entrained to be charitable, and they have the skills to be charitable. And Hank is someone who feels this itch to actually give money to people in need in places of the world.
Yeah.
And so he's found collaborating with the Christian and Mormon transhumanists to be quite gratifying in that regard.
Yeah.
At any rate, that, and for better or worse, that's never been my particular kettle of fish. After I did my 2-year stint in Sri Lanka, I decided to leave development work to more competent at it than I was. And my particular set of issues have always been more philosophical, theological, and, you know, broadly spiritual.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm very interested in Buddhist psychology and how Buddhist psychology might contribute to the transhumanist understanding of transformation. And, mm-hmm. and in particular, Buddhists have this critique of the understanding of the self. We don't think that the self, we think the self is an illusion. And that once you embrace that fact, that that is a liberatory realization, that you can move faster and further in your own spiritual development once you realize that there's no you that you have to protect. And that seems to be a relatively novel thing to say in these philosophical and spiritual circles.
Yeah.
I think it has some pretty direct relevance to concerns that transhumanists have had for a while about how fast and radically an individual or a species could change and still maintain any of the things that would give life meaning. So Max Moore, you know, one of the transhumanist philosophers, he wrote his dissertation on this topic.
Yeah.
And he came to the conclusion that he didn't become a Buddhist, but he argued that there was personal identity, but that what it resolved down to was maintaining your values. Hmm. So basically, if you become transcendent, you know, post-human, and you decide at some point to erase all of your memories of your previous life, which is what the traditional position on personal identity is that some continuity of memory across time. And if you did that, according to Max's thesis, as long as you maintained the same value structure, then you were the same person. Now, the problem with that point of view is that then, ipso facto, you would also be identical to all other people who had the same beliefs in the world.
Right.
And it wouldn't make any difference if you continued to exist, because they still would, so you would just whack yourself. So, you know, all of the positions that people come up with in the transhumanist community are basically dancing around this fact that the self is an illusion.
Yeah.
And if you just accept that, then you can move on and say, you know, we don't have to worry, am I more my real me when I'm taking Ritalin or when I'm not taking Ritalin, or I'm taking Prozac, I'm not taking Prozac. And if I copy my brain and put one in silicon and one in meat, which one's the real me? It's like, bad question. It just doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I think Buddhism can offer. Theologically, I've been writing this book, Cyborg Buddha. And when I started writing it, it was originally going to be about the questions of happiness and what it means to be happy in a transhuman future, and what it means to work on your spiritual life, basically, with technologies that we were developing, meditation, pills, and things like that. And then this debate, I started to realize that there was this broader debate. I had always shied away from Aristotelian virtue ethics because I thought it was a reactionary Catholic thing. And I had always argued that Buddhism was more consistent with utilitarian consequentialism, which is basically the greatest good for the greatest number. Buddhists are supposed to be overcoming suffering of all sentient beings, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, you have to stand on your head just to, as a Buddhist, to ignore the fact that the Buddha was talking about character improvement as the path to all that. Right? And a lot of Buddhist ethicists have said, no. Buddhism's a lot more like Aristotelianism. It has a lot more in common with the Catholic tradition of virtue ethics than it does with John Stuart Mill. And eventually, as I began to write this second book, I acknowledged the wisdom of that. So that led me back into an engagement with religious virtue theories, Christian, Buddhist. We have virtue theories in Buddhism. And then the contemporary positive psychology movement, which has been attempting to kind of do a cross-cultural investigation of virtue theory and ground it in some kind of psychological neuroscience. And that has really been the basis of the direction my work's taken. And I think it's I just was at this meeting on cosmism in New York, and the cosmists had roots in the Russian Orthodox Church back when Russian ones did it, right? And so I was making this argument that cosmism, to the extent that it has any legs, it needs to see itself as a flavor of spiritual transhumanism, and that spiritual transhumanism has this critical role for transhumanists about talking about questions that they have largely ignored because they're mostly libertarian. They're not mostly libertarian. They're libertarian in terms of personal life. And so almost all transhumanists are uncomfortable talking about in any judgmental way about personal choices, right? Saying, is it right or wrong to live your life as a meth head? Oh, well, if that's your choice, they may be left wing in terms of progressive taxation or national health insurance. But when it comes to being libertarian in that respect, most transhumanists are hands off on other people's lives. And I consider that just to be an abdication of A, common sense, and B, morality, to say, if you see somebody who's obviously, enslaving themselves or doing themselves harm, you have an obligation. We there are limits. We have a society in which people can do harm to themselves in certain ways, but we have obligations to care about one another.
Yeah.
And that obligation means that we need to at least say, hey, I think it might be better if you read a book instead of took meth. and I would be glad to come over there and help you. If you need a book to read, and I'll take that crack pipe out of your mouth if you need me to. I think this is part of that discussion. It's like, what does it mean to have a good character? What does it mean in terms of religious terms? It's soteriology. What does it mean to be saved?
Yeah.
What's the path of salvation, of enlightenment, etc. What's the character that kind of thing builds?
Mm-hmm.
And so I see this as a critical piece of what religion can do for transhumanism. Now, transhumanism then has to come back to the religious and say, yeah, well, it doesn't mean freaking out when gay dudes kiss, because that has absolutely nothing to do with human character. and it also means accepting that taking ADD meds may help you accomplish it a hell of a lot faster than prayer. So there's things that both sides have to see each other.
You know, it struck me, you're talking about kind of the Buddhist conception of identity. And it's interesting because it appears that there is a Buddhist conception of identity, which is that there is, it's a theory of identity, which is that there is no identity. I think the Christian theory of identity is much looser or ambiguous. But what I've heard from a lot of theologians is that identity, in the best way of understanding identity in the Christian context, is to understand it as springing from relationship. So we talk about our relationship with God, which gives us that identity, and then our relationship with others, which supports that identity. And that kind of connects to what you're saying. Like, there are it's not okay just to leave people to be meth heads or whatever, right? There's a point at which they go beyond the boundaries of a certain kind of identity that we are recognizing. And so, we work, or we wish to work, to bring them back, to reconnect them with that. And so both our concern for helping people in some ways, and our way of thinking about the ways in which we change and evolve and so forth spring from that kind of relational framework. That's a really intriguing thing. And this issue, so I guess one question would be, do you think that the Buddhist conception of identity promotes more rapid kind of personal evolution than some others might?
Well, let me go back to the Christian one first and say the best essay that I've ever seen on Christian concepts of the soul mm-hmm. in relationship to transhumanism as an essay called The Soul of Transhumanism by Ted Peters, who's Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. I think he's emeritus now.
Yeah.
But he's written a couple books about Christian bioethics that are as close as you can get to a transhumanist point of view within Christian theology.
Yeah.
He's, you know, pretty sanguine about human genetic modification and has argued that Christians shouldn't freak out about it because a lot of the arguments don't make sense from a Christian theological point of view.
Right.
And his argument about the soul is very interesting. I mean, he's basically does not see a biblical justification for a substance dualist view of the soul.
Right.
And argues for exactly what you just said, which is that the soul is whenever any mind turns itself to God. It's the capacity of any mind mm-hmm. to have to be turned to the divine.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very interesting. Now he has a problem. The one place where he draws the line is uploading.
Yeah.
Because he says he just doesn't think that an upload or a machine mind would have that same capacity. I don't see why his argument doesn't
right.
work for uploads and machine minds, but because yeah. it seemed to make a perfect sense that if a robot could have the same capacity for spiritual reflection and awe or whatever we consider turning your mind to God is, then that would it would have a soul too. But
yeah.
at any rate, I think that there's a way in which we can argue within a biblical or Christian context for an understanding of what it means to be an ensouled being mm-hmm. that is consistent with a transhumanist point of view. However, the way it's been traditionally framed is that Christians are substance dualists. They believe, souls split in and out of the body, and that the Enlightenment point of view is that there's no soul. And we go back to John Locke. I don't know if you've ever studied John Locke, but John Locke is the kind of touch point for Enlightenment views of personal identity. And the reason that he first started to reflect on this in his work is he has a passage where he says, what would God need at the judgment to judge us? And what would he need to reconstruct? And he says, well, being God, it wouldn't make any sense for him to have to pull back together all the atoms. He could if he wanted to, but it wouldn't make any sense for him to pull back all the atoms that were part of our body at the point of our death. What point would that be?
Yeah.
All he really needs to do to judge us is to pull back together our memories. Because if you don't remember the things that you did in your life, you can't be judged. Right? He said, or at least it would be a huge injustice if you
yeah.
were. And so, therefore, your personal identity is fundamentally your memories. Now, that takes us in an entirely different direction. There's no substance dualism involved. There's no body involved. You don't even need your body. All you need is those memories. They could be substrate independent, as we say now. It could be in silicon. It could be in the ether. Whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's the key Enlightenment focus is on the subjectivity of being alive in the world, the liberal individual self. It's predicated on this un-Buddhist idea that the liberal individual self has a personal identity that's continuous through time, that's discrete from other things, et cetera. That's what the Buddhists disagree with.
Yeah.
But the subjectivity, the focus on subjectivity, as opposed to the substance dualist aspect of some Holy Spirit flitting in out of your body, that's the part that is kind of transitional to the Buddhist view. It says, okay, well, let's take a look at that subjectivity.
Yeah.
And as you begin to understand that subjectivity, you begin to see there ain't nothing there. There's this part of yourself and that part of yourself and this part of your subjectivity and that part. There's the part that gets up in the morning and says, I'm never going to smoke a cigarette again. And then you buy a pack at 3 o'clock and then you crumple them up at six
right.
and then you come in cigarettes from your friend again at 9 o'clock at night. Which one was the real you? So
right.
That's the problem.
Yeah. I think you make a good point about the issues with substance dualism. If we, accept a substance dualist view, there's no reason that I can see why if a physical human body is constructed of carbon and then we construct a different being out of silicon, then I'm not sure why that can also have a soul. If there's a immaterial soul that has to attach to it. But if we reject that view, which I think most Orthodox theologians now would say they reject that view, then then we're back where you said, you know, why couldn't this mind turn itself to God? Why couldn't it be in relationship? And I agree. I haven't really seen a strong argument from a Christian theological point of view against that possibility. Right. So,
I mean, Brent, I did a debate with Brent Peters about 8 years ago. He's, I think he's in Chicago, one of the seminaries there. But anyway, he has written a book about the significance of being imago Dei, mm-hmm. Being in the image of God, which again, as not being a Christian, it's like, if you tell me that human beings were made in the image of God, and this is what the image of God is, it's like, no. I mean, obviously, you have to become a transhumanist, because we're not doing God any justice at all if this is the image of God.
Right.
You know, at least God's got to be something bigger than us. So anyway, his argument was that Jesus, in imago Dei, you know, the importance of Jesus as an embodied human being kind of constrains the ideas of what human transcendence could possibly be to be human, to remain. Yeah. And okay, you know, but you know, my argument's always been, you know, if a human being wants to live forever and have green skin and wings and you know, clone itself into multiple boxes, it ain't going to do nothing to God's plan, right? you may just then be alive when the judgment happens, and God won't have to pull you back together again.
Right.
You know, the concept of God, and this is Ted Peters' argument, the concept of God in which you can somehow interfere with God's plan with your puny human machinations is a concept of God that's Greco-Roman. It's like God's up on Mount Olympus, and you're going to arm yourself up as Hercules and run up and grab his scepter. It's like, that's not the Christian conception of God.
Right. Yeah, and actually, I think the image of God thing is central for Christians and is very important, but in where that appears in Genesis 1, it's in the context of God being defined almost entirely as a creative being, a being who creates and who names and who cares about things. And then he says, I'm going to create a being like me in my image. And that's the characteristic that's being communicated. And I actually just heard a great talk about this at a conference I was at a couple of weeks ago. They were saying, Jesus being definitive, you know, for Christians it's important that he's embodied. It's important that he, you know, has this experience of relationality and individuality and being physical. But it's not important that he's Aramaic, right? Like, we're not saying that all human beings actually need to.
Or dude.
Right. Yeah, exactly, right? Like, these are not the characteristics of Jesus that are important for Christians to be trying to emulate. It's not just the, whether he had five fingers or four fingers or six fingers or whatever, right? So, I think you're right. The arguments that head off into that territory lead you pretty quickly to places you don't want to go, right? And I think that's why I think it has been important in the Christian tradition to keep centering that back on these kind of spiritual properties and our relationality and things like that, rather than the particularities of, you know, whatever we think of as the human bodily form at this precise moment in time.
Right. Now, let me mention another aspect of all of this that's been of interest to me for a long time. And that's the kind of sociology of millennialism and apocalypticism. Mm. I've been interested in it both as a religious sociology phenomenon studied and have written about the significance of Buddhist millennialism. Yeah. Buddhist millennialism played a role in Buddhist politics in Burma and China, Japan, and Sri Lanka, other places. not in quite as dramatic a fashion as it has in Western culture.
Yeah, interesting.
But of course, now it's a huge role in ISIS and so forth. And one of the arguments that I've, one of the things I've been interested in is how religious culture is going to appropriate the techno-millennialism that's coming out of the singularitarian and transhumanist view. And you know, whether they're going to see that as a part of the fulfillment of prophecy, or, and on which side, and right. you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So there's this guy Tom Warren who has been one of my favorite interlocutors on this. He's a Christian evangelical far right. He's not even far right. He's part of the WAC end of the Christian yeah. spectrum, and he runs a website. That basically interprets every piece of technological news through this kind of perspective. So, right. you know, if DARPA is trying to figure out how to put prosthetic arms on people, his headline is DARPA to arm, you know, human angel hybrids in the end times with artificial arms.
Right, right.
And if we discover water on Mars, it's like, you know, the ancient watchers from the other side of the dimension of hell have been discovered right. on Mars or something like that.
Right.
But he and I have become friends because I decided a long time ago that, you know, if there's somebody like this, you know, who's this whacked out, I don't want him coming after me with a gun. So I'm going to be his favorite transhumanist. I mean, whatever he wants from me, you know, he could be on my radio show, I'll be on his radio show, we'll be best buds. So Tom Horton and I have had a number of these kinds of conversations, and I just find it fascinating. You know, mm-hmm. it's like he doesn't think anything transhumanist is a fulfillment of prophecy. It's the mirror image of the Mormon transhumanists who yeah. are seeing everything about transhumanism as the fulfillment of the positive end of yeah. their prophecy about men becoming gods, theosis. And I think a lot of people in the world are going to be someplace in between in yeah. terms of, you know, how they appropriate technological yeah. change in the coming decades.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think that's, you know, what always gets said is like the rapture of the nerds, right? Like right. there is within almost every conversation about, you know, the technological possibilities, there is this kind of implicit millennialism that, you know, of some sort, right? Whether it's the fundamentalist kind of disaster version of it, like you were describing, or whether it's kind of a positive version of it, where this is, you know, this is the ultimate salvation. And yeah, for me, I've really been trying to advocate for a much more Jewish sort of approach to eschatology. And I think if you look at the more ancient kind of Jewish approach, the apocalyptic is all through the Old Testament. And so Exodus is the prime example of the apocalyptic. And it's
apocalypse happened to them every couple decades.
That's right. Yeah. That's and that was how they viewed the world, you know, and so you know, for them the Exodus was the apocalypse. It was the first one, and then they were gonna have other ones, and they were, you know, and so they had a way of understanding the apocalyptic which connected them to the struggle that they were facing at that time in their history, connected them to a real world struggle. And it's very much in contrast to the kind of apocalyptic sentiment that says, well, let's all go out on a mountain and, you know, sell our houses and leave our jobs and all that kind of stuff and go out here and wait for the world to end, like Harold Camping did in 2011. You know, there's, it's a much more engaged and proactive approach, which says, you know, injustice cannot stand. And it's the kind of apocalyptic that you see in Martin Luther King and the way he talked about kind of semi-prophetically about his dream for the future. And he used biblical language to talk about that. And it was very much connected to social change and to, you know, how we needed to change as humanity. So
this is one of the threads that's been of great interest to me is that, again, it connects the social justice, as you suggested. You know, do you see the agency of change in millennial? I'm not an anti-millennialist. I'm not an anti-utopian. Yeah. And I certainly believe that apocalyptic things are possible through completely natural agencies, you know, yeah. in the future. And so what I'm concerned about is whether people have a fatalistic attitude
right.
or adopt some kind of magical thinking about the things that are coming. So, for instance, I think those who are sitting around in San Francisco imagining that they're doodling to try to create friendly AI is some kind of magical incantation, which is going to prevent a global Terminator scenario
yeah.
instead of engaging politically with the existent agencies that are working on cybersecurity and international cyber terrorism and machine ethics. There's a conference every week on machine ethics. And you're sitting down here, you're thinking, oh, if I can just design this friendly AI first, it'll take over the whole world.
Right.
It'll save us all from the bad demons. And it's like, that's magical thinking.
Right.
Or if you're sitting back and thinking, I can smoke and drink and be as fat as I want because a singularity's coming and, I don't have to worry about any of this stuff. Well, that's the kind of fatalism that, that affects a lot of millennials. If you think that we have a critical human agency involved in determining the fate of the human race, that it's not prophecy. It's, prophecy is intrinsically fatalistic one way or the other, which is one of the problems of prophecy. I don't understand why people like Tom Horn get so upset. It's like, he knows I'm going to lose. So why does he give a crap?
Right.
It's like, he's going to save one person from James Hughes in the end times. It's like, okay, whatever. But if you have to believe that human agency has some critical role to play, and that's called the post-millennialist perspective. That's the notion that if you want to bring about the kingdom of heaven on earth, human beings have to be involved in this process. It's not just Jesus coming down with a flaming sword. We have a role.
Yeah. Yeah. And I heard you in some context talk about the need for kind of understanding the continuity between our different efforts. So, in the transhumanist kind of conversation, we talk about enhancing brain power or whatever. And you were pointing out that we have a lot of ways of doing that right now that are better nutrition, better education, things like that, and that it's important to see these things as part of a continuum and not separated where it's a radically different project.
Exactly. I mean, we stopped becoming humans 1.0 at least 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago when we invented symbolic thought.
Yeah.
We started downloading the contents of our brain onto external storage media and uploading them again through our eyes. We became cyborgs at that point.
Yeah.
So, the notion that there's some kind of radical, in 5 years, we're going to figure out how to genetically modify X and then all hell will break loose because we won't be human anymore. No, our genes have been changing radically because of urbanization, for the last 10,000 years or 5,000, whatever. So, yeah, I think that this is a key part of what the transhumanists have to be saying to people. On the one hand, transhumanists want to say, look at the bright new future that's coming. On the other hand, we have to constantly remind ourselves and everybody else, this is a part of a 10,000-year history. We're just the next logical thing that's coming down the road.
Yeah. So what would you say is the most important thing? You kind of talked about the relationship between the secular transhumanist and the religious world and kind of the back and forth that needs to happen there, kind of give and take. What do you think is the most important thing for Christian transhumanist or religious transhumanist to be focusing on or maybe learning in this process?
Well, I heard a great quote yesterday when I was at the Cosmos meeting. Charlie Jane Enders, who writes for IO9, the website IO9, she said that smug atheists should read more science fiction.
Yeah.
And I think this is a pretty important point because, here's Nick Bostrom. He's nice guy, brilliant. I've learned so much from him, benefited so much. But he couldn't give a crap about science fiction or religion.
Yeah.
But he came up with a 1,000-word essay or something. He came up with one of the most fundamentally theological arguments of modern time, which is starting to influence, swaths of fiction and nonfiction, philosophy, et cetera. Basically, that we're living in the mind of God. It's pretty likely, he said, we're living in the mind of God.
Right.
Oh, really? Okay, and that's not a theological argument. And you don't think that anybody who's ever said that before might be an interesting person to then think about what they had to say about it.
Right.
Or Kurzweil, who suggests that part of humanity's destiny is to make the entire universe intelligent, and that we may, in fact, be bathing in the product of previous intelligences in the universe, Or Carl Schroeder, who says, you know, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from nature. It's like, these are all theological concepts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Where at least you have to acknowledge that there's no place to draw a line.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so funny that more and more, you know, when I read people talking about kind of theoretic arguments about how AI is going to operate and how what it's going to do and what its, you know, what its limits are and all of these kinds of things, that the more I read that, the more it sounds like kind of old-fashioned theology, because there it's asking the question of like, what does a mind look like when it's unleashed, right? Which is what all the kind of ancient Christians were asking and doing theology based on, right?
Exactly. And so Nick, you know, is at least open-minded about it and a little bit worried about it. It's like, you know, the truly unbound mind might turn the universe into paperclips.
Yeah.
The Mormon theologians come along and say, well, anything that smart is going to be nice, and therefore, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's going to be a nice universe. So, yeah, but it's all theological speculation at that point. I'm still non-theist. So, I still prefer to imagine the universe as the product. I don't know if you've ever heard, you know, the Buddhist creation myth is that the universe is not created at all. It's just something that happens.
Yeah.
But every once in a while it collapses and all the beings lose their bodies and the non-reincarnated souls are out in kind of ether someplace. And then it comes back into existence. And the first ones to filter back down have the worst karma. Right, they were the ones with the best karma, the ones who get to stay in their ethereal states the longest. The ones with the worst karma are the first ones to come back down in, and they look around and they say, "We must have made this place because we're the first ones here." So they call themselves the gods. And then the next ones come in, and the next ones come in. The first ones can't say, "We made this place. We're the gods," and the rest of them say, "Oh, you're the gods." So, the whole Buddhist creation myth is to poke a finger in the eye of that kind of theistic imagination. So I'm not saying I do or don't believe in any of these theories because Buddhism said X, Y, or Z. But there's a certain elective affinity that I have for not living in a created universe.
Right.
Or at least, you know, if we are in a simulated universe, I think that the idea of what that kind of intelligence would be, it's not a kid with a chemistry set. It's,
right.
There's some kind of cosmic process.
Yeah.
You know, I can like, I'm more comfortable with the idea of like a biophilic universe, that universes that have the kind of life that we do also tend to generate the kinds of intelligence that can create other universes. And therefore, there's probably a kind of lineage or an ecological affinity of life for life in the universes that get created.
Hmm.
I can deal with that.
You know?
But the idea that there's some kid with a chemistry set who I then have to say prayers to or tip my hat to, who gives a crap about my existence.
Right.
I don't find any of that very good.
Yeah, I think when people try to explain the simulation argument or, you know, variance on it, that's what people go to, right? That or the guy playing a video game in his basement. That's the assumption that's kind of what is leading into. And of course, that doesn't actually really fit with the argument. It just seems like a good analogy, right? I think that's actually a lot of the aversion to it, and a lot of it's kind of typical of transhumanism in general, is the sorts of ways we want to describe things when we analyze them. You know, like we analyze something like love or morality or compassion or something like that, and then we start to use some kind of crazy images to describe it. Like you said, like a kid with a chemistry set or something. And then people develop a very strong aversion to that because it seems like we've just, you know, junked it, right? We've made some, you know, crap out of it. So I think that's something we have to be careful of, even just how we talk about, or how we describe some of these things. And so that another thing you mentioned, was, I think the idea of vision and the idea of, you know, how we think about the future in our culture and our society. So what are some of the things you've been looking into there?
Well, brother, without a vision, the people perish. So,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds familiar. That's
So, and I take that to heart. I mean, I think we live in a post-ideological age, and I understand why if you were a young Chinese today, anybody coming along with some new ism, you'd just run the other way.
Yeah.
But I think that it's a part of at least human nature as we currently exist, that we need collective, inspiring understandings and stories about what we can be and become.
Yeah.
That give both our collective life meaning and also give our individual lives meaning. I mean, there's in sociology, we talk about this in terms of anomie and alienation. You know, if you get up in the morning and you don't, as I said when I was in high school, you know, it's like we're just floating atoms in space and there's no actual right and wrong. And, you know, I could just go kill someone like, you know, in L'Étranger and it wouldn't have any meaning whatsoever. It's like, you know, that people right. lose their shit over that. And sorry, I don't know if this is a PG-13 podcast.
We'll find out. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's bad for people. It makes them unhappy. It's also bad for societies. It turns out that societies then become vulnerable to mimetic infections. Mm. When they kind of lose their mimetic immune systems, they become vulnerable to things like ISIS, mm. you know, who comes along and says, look, the Quran says that you need these five characteristics to be the Mahdi in the modern times. And Baghdadi has them, and therefore you must come and die for the homeland. And, you know, fascism and communism and things like that before. So we need to engage with positive, liberal, democratic, utopian visions of the future that are that guard against that, you know, that do fulfill us and move us forward,
yeah.
give us a reason to get out of bed in the morning, even if we have to practice a certain amount of doublethink. I mean, I'm not a moral realist, and I recognize how historically bound all of my visions of the future are and how in 100 years or 200 years, my descendants will look back on my ideas as quaint and simple-minded or even reactionary as I look back on the utopian visions of my great-grandparents.
Yeah.
And fine, I know that I'm that historically bounded. But, you know, at this point in history, we need these kinds of visions, and there are better ones and worse ones.
Yeah.
And the worst ones can be really, really bad, and we need to prevent them spreading. And one of the ways to do that is to latch on to the really good ones or a body of good ones and push those ones forward. So this is why I've yeah. always been what I called a mimetic engineer. I've always been interested in what's the best parts of, you know, democratic socialism and Buddhism and Unitarianism and transhumanism that we can put together and create the kind of ideal set of, and it's not so much, you know, one ideal doctrine. I'm not so much interested in writing manifestos anymore. I see the IET as kind of a space. Mm-hmm. In which there's people from the libertarian end to the radical left end. There's people from the atheist end to the secular end. But we're kind of centering on a vortex of questions and common assumptions that will hold us together so that we address the right kinds of questions. And I'm comfortable in that space because depending on which side of the bed I get up in the morning, I feel more one way or the other. You know, sometimes yeah. I feel more religious and more atheist, and sometimes I feel more libertarian and more leftist and so on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's comfortable space for me as well. So I'm not saying that, you know, we need a vision, mm-hmm. but we need visions, positive visions that will help us fight the bad ones.
Yeah. So I kind of have a probably a biased viewpoint in this. Where do you think that... like, where do you think we can go mining for those kinds of visions or those memes or whatever that we need to kind of create positive effects in society?
Well, I think, you know, I've always been a kind of a Jungian. I think that our collective mythological experience provides an enormous amount of grist for the mill and
yeah.
lessons. For that, that's partly my Unitarian background as well. So, you know, Unitarians think, basically, if we just boiled everything down and
right.
pulled out all the dross and it all looked like Unitarian Universalism,
right.
it's like, well, I'm not so sure about that anymore. But at least, you know, if we do investigate with an open mind, you know, it's like what I used to do with as a Buddhist exegete is, you know, I'd study Buddhism and I'd say, look, Buddhism's feminist. Then I'd say, oh, look, Buddhism's socialist. And then I'd say, look, Buddhism's atheist. And right. you know what? That's not an authentic dialogue with the tradition. That's
right.
the silliest form of exegetical work, and it took me a while to stop doing that. So now I can say, look, Buddhism is nothing, and all the things that it's been at the same time. 2,500 years, 50 different countries, you've had Buddhist racists, Buddhist militarists, Buddhist pacifists, you've all got the whole shebang.
Yeah.
The kind of thing I'm interested in, and the reasons that I'm interested in my nihilist tradition have to do with this, this, and this. Now, I think every Christian has to do the same thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's very useful because for Christian transhumanists to do it, Christian liberals to do it, progressives, whatever, because the majority of the world is probably going to continue to be religious. I mean, the sad demographic fact is that seculars don't have enough kids. And religious folks all over the world have twice the fertility rate that secular people do.
Right.
So there ain't going to be no secular awakening because the number of Christians is going to continue to grow, number of Muslims is going to continue to grow, at least as long as this fertility thing happens.
Yeah.
Now, if you know, the other things could happen in the world, we could see about that. But.
Yeah.
So we need to engage in this dialogue, and we need to do it within the mythological structures that people already have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's what you said about the kind of Unitarian Universalist desire to boil things down, you know, to where we just end up with, I guess, kind of a universal monomyth. That's the word I'm stumbling over here, but that becomes very, very thin at some points if we're not kind of constantly refreshing things with. Maybe more organic parts of our tradition as well, and I mentioned Martin Luther King because he does this, right? He pulls out things, you know, like justice roll on like a river or whatever, you know, that aren't just kind of a vanilla mythos, right? they're specific things that have come from specific experiences of people in history and have this evocative nature because of that.
I think it is possible to have a techno spirituality, a modern spirituality, which is purely motivated, which finds the same kinds of sources of inspiration in science, quantum physics, at cosmology, without having to have all of the mythological and supernatural overlay that the traditional religion does. I think it's possible.
Yeah.
But for me, the things, the versions of that I've seen are still not satisfying in comparison to a Buddhism, which has, you know, here's the deity with the 12 arms, and this arm it means this, and that arm
right.
means that, and you meditate on this color, and it generates this emotion, and people have been doing this for
right.
2,500 years, you know,
right.
and that has a little bit more oomph to it than saying, Carl Sagan thought looking at the stars was an awesome experience, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think that's so true. There's so much depth that these traditions have because they've been around so long, because they've worked over some of these ideas so much, and so many people have poured so much energy and imagination and vision into them that just even from a secular perspective, it seems a shame to kind of let them go to waste, right? Why wouldn't that be fuel for whatever else, you know, we want to do or whatever. This is a big, you know, a big thing for me is kind of what visions are we turning to in our society and what visions are we turning to as a culture. And I guess one of my fears is that we have a largely cynical kind of vision. So a lack of vision, I guess, you know, that seems to be pretty firmly embedded in the way that a lot of us think about things, at least in certain generational groups. Do you think that's the case? And does that worry you, or do you think we're good with that? Are we moving past that, or is that not a problem?
This has been a long question in social science. The functionalist view, just to go back to my classic social science theory, the functionalist view was that when you lived in small bands, if everybody pretty much knew how to take care of themselves, the thing that held a village together was their common myths and their beliefs about the legitimacy of their power structure. And so having some kind of normative consensus in a small town or village was important. Now, it's always been a question whether that's really true or not. But the idea was that once we became a big complex society, what changes? Well, the first thing that changes is it's impossible for us all to believe the same thing.
Yeah.
And we're exposed to the myriad of ways that people can believe things in the world. And that creates a certain postmodern crisis, because it's impossible to believe anything with the same depth once you realize that there are so many other people in the world who believe other things just as fervently as you do, and that the only reason you believe the things you do is because you happen to be born in the place that you were.
Yeah.
And that means it's you just can't believe things the same way people used to. So that's the postmodern crisis, and that's inescapable. Now, in that situation, how does society continue to work? Well, like people like Durkheim thought, well, it's because nobody can afford to defect anymore. It used to be you could, yeah, if you didn't believe what other people believed, you could just take your spear and walk off into the woods. Like, go ahead and try, you know, you can't do that anymore. So the what we believe in now is that we're all dependent on one another,
yeah,
whether we actually believe the same thing or not. I think that that's to a certain degree true. And that as a consequence, we just will have to accept that there's this postmodern erosion of certainty moving forward. Now, I don't think that that is necessarily, and as I said, this is one of the things that led me to become a Buddhist in the first place, is that, yes, that can be disorienting. If you think you need to know the exact truth of the universe in order to get out of bed in the morning, then that can be pretty disorienting once you realize there is no exact truth to be had. But if what you think you need to do is have a working project, you know, towards a certain goal that a lot of people seem to share, then that can be enough. And this is you see this with people like Sam Harris, who, you know, is a pretty interesting philosopher, but a crap at metaethics. And he wrote this whole book about good and bad, where he said, look, it's just self-evident that liberal democracy and, you know, modernity is what's best for people, and that is self-evidently good, and that everybody who thinks otherwise should just, you know, look at the facts. And it's like, that's not the convincing argument. It's like the Taliban, the ISIS, they do not consider that a convincing argument.
Yeah.
You know, you have to acknowledge that coming to a conclusion about one thing being good versus another is purely your conclusion. It has no, you know, even the fact that you think that people are happier in one condition than another, that's irrelevant in some systems of thought. You know,
yeah.
Happy people can be on the path to hell.
Right.
So at any rate, I think we do need to come up with these collective projects. And I think the Liberal Democratic Project is a pretty good one. Mm-hmm. And it may be that it's superseded once the Borg arrives on the scene and we all realize that jacking into the singularity is superior to having representative democracy and capitalism.
Right.
You know, who knows what's going to happen. But for right now, defending liberal democracy, extending the sphere of individual rights, making sure that people have more and more equality, that kids don't get shot by cops, you know, all the things that I think are good projects right now,
yeah,
will probably help us establish a better transhuman future in 2030 and in 2040 and in 2050.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. There's so many things that I want to ask you and explore, but I think this is probably where I should let you go. And maybe we can come back later and I can ask you all kinds of other interesting questions. But thanks so much for joining me here. And where can people find out more about the Cyborg Buddha Project and IEET and all of those kinds of things?
So IEET is at IEET.org, and we have a very active website, and there's links to the Cyborg Buddha Project. It's mostly, at this point, the feed of articles that are related to the topics that I described. But we did do a conference that people could look up, the Moral Brain Conference at Yale, NYU, New York University, 3 years ago, and we're planning to do more, of course, on this topic. And I'm writing a book about it, and probably eventually it will get done, actually.
it's hopefully so. It's,
yes, we'll see. But yes, so all of that's there at the IEET. We also have mailing lists, and there's lots of multimedia content. So there's a Facebook group.
Yeah,
join us.
All right. Well, thanks so much, James. And I'll talk to you later.
Okay, you too. All right.